This morning we have representatives from Ford and Ford Credit this morning, so it's going to be back-to-back slots. Really appreciate all of you spending time with us this week. From Ford, we have Dave Dickinson sitting on the front row. We have Neil Schloss and K.R. Kent that are going to go through Ford and Ford Credit. So without further delay, we're going to get started.
Thanks, Eric. And what we'd like to do today, and as Eric mentioned, is we'll give you a quick overview on the strategic side of Ford and what we're headed for from a standpoint of strategy. And then KR will do a more detailed review into Ford Credit, into the specific performance of the assets, et cetera. The other thing is this is going to be webcasted, so to the extent that when we get into the Q&A session, if you can come to one of the mics, it would be appreciated. And for those of you who were stuck in the snow over the weekend, we filed our 10K last Thursday to make sure you had something to read while you were stuck in your house. And so the 227 pages, we expect you all to have read it as we go forward. So today's theme of the first part of the presentation is going to be on building a foundation for success. And our view is, as we went into this last crisis and coming out of it, it's really important to be focused on the vital few and the vital few priorities, and collectively gather the team and the resources around delivering those priorities. The first thing to deal with, and we obviously had to deal with a lot of it, were the economic realities, and take decisive restructuring actions along the way. And just as importantly, you have to be prepared and prepare yourself so when you're coming out of it, you have the right products and a detail, and so you haven't underinvested at the most critical time, so you have the products when you're coming out of it, and really establishing a foundation for long-term growth. And while we certainly have faced, and a lot of us here in the room have faced, a lot of adversity over the last few years, and specifically the last 18 months, we were able to stick with our plan and really execute what was important to us. And if we think about the left side of the slide, which is dealing with all the things we need to deal with, lined up with our One Ford plan, it really is very consistent. And our four main pillars of that plan continue to be aggressively restructure the business to operate profitably at the current demand and changing model mix, to accelerate our product development that consumers want and value, to finance our plan and improve our balance sheet, and importantly, to work together as one team and leveraging our global assets around the world. So when you look at the recent history, we have aggressively been restructuring our business, first with Europe in the early part of this decade, and then second with North America. But in the past 3 years, with the One Ford plan, we've had to accelerate that restructuring even further. What we thought were tough business conditions before this last recession has turned out to be the good old days, and we actually like a few of those back. But what we have seen in the last couple years, and if you start at sort of the upper part of this slide, the global economic decline, obviously significant and anemic sales around the world in most regions, with exception of maybe China, volatile oil prices, continuing changement in segment mixes, and then last but definitely not least, the tight credit markets. And while this was going on, the industry itself was restructuring, both here in America, but also around the world. So as the industry sales fell in the beginning of 2008, we continued to take restructuring actions. And then as industry sales continued to fall, we continued to take actions to restructure our business. We got a little bit of a positive last July and August with the Cash for Clunkers program, but subsequent to that, industry sales fell back down to the levels that they were running previously, and the latest two dot points, December and January, have been in the 11.5 and 11 million unit range. So in continuing to adjust to these new realities, by the end of 2009, we have reduced our structural costs by $14 billion since 2005. As a result of the sharp decline in industry volumes and wholesale sales, including the actions that we took to reduce dealer stocks, and that's an important element of our business to make sure that we're not putting more stocks into dealerships that can sell, it obviously had an impact and a big impact on our cash outflows. But despite the fact that we've had continued sales declines, our cash burn has slowed significantly in the first half of 2009 and actually turned positive in the second half, and it's all because of the decisive actions that we took early on to make sure that we were matching demand with supply, as well as continuing to invest in new products that we now have in the marketplace. The next key element of the One Ford plan was to accelerate the development of new products that consumers want and value. This is a product business. I mean, there's no other way around it from the standpoint. You have to be able to emerge when you're coming out of an economic downturn. You have to be able to emerge with product line and products that are current and fresh and have all the updated technology that is available. So early on, we made some fundamental decisions in the business, and that was to not stop investing. We had to continue to invest in product. We made difficult decisions when it came to divesting of brands. Jaguar, Land Rover, Aston Martin, and now Volvo is being held for sale to give us that laser focus, to focus on the Ford brand globally. So integrating all the Ford companies around the world into a single One Ford company. We committed to producing a balanced product of vehicles, small, medium, and large, cars, utilities, and trucks. We balanced the lineup, and we're in the process of making most of our plants flexible and to be well-positioned to respond to where the customer demands are and customer needs are. And we really began the journey to global product development to truly leverage our scale and our expertise and stop operating as many independently run Ford entities around the world. And we have achieved substantial and continuous improvement in engineering and investment efficiencies, and I'll show you a couple slides in a second with the specific numbers. But reducing vehicle platforms, engines, transmissions, and consumer complexity. We focused on reducing the average age of our product portfolio, and I'll show you the numbers in a second. And we raised our standards for product excellence, which equals the best designed vehicles in the world. This sounds obvious, but in the past, that sometimes hasn't happened at Ford. As we reduced our brand portfolio, we also reduced the number of nameplates we've had globally. In the process, we've clarified and simplified our lineup, supporting our focus on the Ford brand around the world. And we will continue to reduce the nameplates as we've moved forward. And clearly in the U.S., we did not have a complete balanced portfolio of vehicles, and it was heavily weighted on trucks. By 2008, we had begun to rebalance our lineup to deliver more cars and utilities that consumers increasingly wanted, while still maintaining our strong portfolio of trucks, which has been known to be our specialty. Included in utilities are crossover utility vehicles that are based on car platforms, sport utility vehicles that are based on truck platforms. Although not shown in the slide, within the utility section, there's a shift being made toward smaller crossovers and car-based utilities. But strengthening our business and our profit equation requires a balance of both revenue and reducing costs, and I'll talk about both of those now. On the next few slides, I will cover the key initiatives as they relate to cost and our product development. One of the key initiatives is to migrate toward common platforms to improve scale and material cost for both us and our supplier partners. And for example, as we've shown here in the slide, by 2010, the global focus, which will be launched at the end of this year, will have over 900,000 units, with a goal on the C-Car platform to have over 2 million units. The Ford Fiesta, which will launch in North America later this summer, has already launched in Asia and in Europe, 600,000 units by 2012, growing to over 1 million units on that platform. And a couple of very specifics, and you can see how the migration of the vehicles will migrate to global and one global platform and one global vehicle around the world. And this is really the first one, which is the Fiesta, which is launched in Europe and Asia and South America. And you can see the picture of the global one that will come to North America later this summer. Next is the Focus. And you can see in North America Focus, we have our own here. Europe and Asia and South America has their Focus. Again, not one that's been commonly designed and or commonly sourced from the standpoint of suppliers. And then you can see the global Focus, which will be launched later this year, which really was designed from the very beginning to be a global product, and it will have a significant amount of its parts common around the world. In coming years, you've got the Ford Fusion in North America and the Mondeo in Europe and Asia, which will also be moving toward a single global platform. Another example of the global one Ford is the Ford Transit Connect. This is a product that's been selling in Europe for several years and is now launched in North America. And there'll be plenty more products like this as we move forward. Because of the simplification actions I described in our new global product development system, our engineering costs have come down 60% since 2005, and we will continue to improve beyond that. And as a result of that, the new vehicle facilities and tooling costs have also improved by 40%, again, with continued improvement expected in that area as well. But we're clearly not delusional that you can cost cut your way to prosperity. And so the next few slides, I will cover the revenue side of the equation and things we're doing to improve our pricing and our products. In the past 2 years, we've replaced or refreshed 45% of our product lineup, and you can see the list of vehicles. The farthest left were refreshed or new in 2008, and the right side were new in 2009. And that's really just the beginning of what you'll see from the Ford around the world. For those of you who have seen the Car Wars report from last year, the forecast in there was that Ford would have one of, if not the best and most aggressive product plans. We plan to replace 70 to 90% of our lineup in North America, Europe, and Asia by volume by 2012. And by 2014, we'll have refreshed 140 to 160%. So what that means is in the next 5 years, we'll have refreshed or replaced every single vehicle once, and we'll be halfway through the next phase of that refreshing. By 2014, we will have lowered the average age of our product portfolio further by another 20%, which we believe will put us right at the top of the industry as it comes to product freshness. With fewer brands and higher platform volumes, we can better focus our resources on creating outstanding products that consumers really want and value. Our products need to stand for something, and they will have a common DNA. They will look like a Ford, drive like a Ford, and feel like a Ford. They will have quality that is good or better than any of the competition, as verified by key third parties. They will deliver leading fuel economy through advanced internal combustion engine, hybrids, and all-electric powertrains. They will provide industry-best safety through both excellent crash protection and advanced accident avoidance technologies. And they will be equipped with more smart technology like the Ford Sync that will make getting around easier and more pleasurable. Said another way, this product excellence, the best designed vehicles in the world. The new products we are introducing, such as the Ford Fiesta, deliver not only great quality and fuel efficiency, but also safety and technology, and have an emotional appeal that truly connects with the consumer. I'm gratified to see that many of the motoring press agree with us. I should also note that the Fiesta was the second best-selling model in Europe in 2009 and really was a large contributor to the market share growth in Europe to a record 11-year high. Here is the Focus RX. It's the high-performance rocket that we sell in Europe. And as the quote suggests, it's refined enough to drive every day, but it has the personality of a sports car. Next is the Ford Fusion, which we launched last year in both gas and hybrid versions. It's selling very well and is the big reason why we are gaining market share in the U.S. The Fusion Hybrid gets 41 miles per gallon with seamless performance and was honored with the North American Car of the Year Award by the media at the recent North America International Auto Show. The Fusion also won Motor Trend's prestigious 2010 Car of the Year, topping a field of 23 contenders. The Taurus Show with the EcoBoost engine was named Car of the Year by Esquire magazine. And here is the Transit Connect I mentioned earlier, and this really exemplifies the power of leveraging our global lineup. It was honored with the North American Truck of the Year Award at this year's North America International Auto Show. Key to our plan is improving revenue per unit, and we've already are making substantial improvement in this area, as you can see on the slide. Improvement is a function of many things. We are selling a richer mix of vehicles that have more of the features and technologies that consumers want and are willing to pay for. For example, the customers on the F-Series launch in late 2008 are requesting and buying more of the componentry within it and more of the options. And finally, as our products improve and our brand strengthens, we have been able to reduce absolute size of incentives. On the right side of the slide, you can see for the year, net pricing improvements boosted our bottom line by $5.5 billion. In short, we are making substantial progress toward eliminating our brand discount. Products that our customers really want and value also helped us rebuild our market share in the U.S., Europe, and around the world. We have started to see market share gains as we launch our new products around the world. We increased full-year 2009 market share in North America, South America, although not shown here, and Europe compared to 2008. We've gained share in the U.S. We were up to 15.3 percentage points in 2009, an improvement of 1.1 points from 2008. And as I mentioned earlier, Europe hit an 11-year high in market share. These unit revenue and market share gains has really helped us execute the third element of the One Ford strategy, which is financing our plan and improving our balance sheet. Understandably, because of the financial market crisis and the global economic downturn, this is an area that is under intense scrutiny, both inside and outside of Ford. About 3 years ago, we took aggressive action to provide liquidity to execute our plan and to cushion ourselves against the unexpected. The unprecedented freezing of the global credit markets made our decision look even better than it did at the time. In 2009, we have also taken numerous actions to really improve our balance sheet. We reduced our debt by $10.1 billion in March. We raised $1.6 billion of common stock in an offering in May. We qualified and were the first to qualify for $5.9 billion in loans from the Department of Energy for advanced efficiency vehicles. And in November, we amended and extended $7.9 billion of our credit lines from 2011 to 2013. At the same time, we also issued $2.9 billion of convertible bonds and disclosed a $1 billion equity distribution program, about which half is complete. And last but not least, at the end of the year, we completed the transfer of the UAW retiree health care liabilities to the UAW VEBA. As part of the transfer into the VEBA assets, we also prepaid $500 million against the obligations that were transferred to the VEBA. We have and will continue to focus on cash flow to further repair our balance sheet with investment-grade ratings, a clear goal of Ford's. There's a lot more work to do to improve our balance sheet. By following our One Ford plan, we have created a virtuous circle where we are continually improving our balance sheet, reducing our cost, improving our operations through global efficiencies. This gives us the resources we need to create products our customers want and value. Critical elements of this plan is the way our senior team is working together. In hard times, working together as a team is the most important advantage you can create. At Ford, all of our business and functional leaders get together once a week. For those of you who saw the journal, this is the BPR process that we run on a weekly basis. These meetings are data-driven and are very transparent. They are relentlessly focused on conditions that exist today, present reality of the situation, and what we are going to do to improve them. Meetings can be exacting, but ground rules make it clear that we are all there to support each other to succeed as a group. We'll deal with reality, and we will act decisively. Now, I've given you an overview of the foundation for success that we have been building over the last few years. The next few slides are slides that we took out of the earnings deck that are there for your reference, but don't plan to cover them, at least in the formal presentation, and we can address your questions later. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to KR, who will take you through the Ford credit material.
Thank you, Neil. I'm going to take you through some of the Ford credit slides that we had from our earnings call, as well as just give a little bit of flavor on what's going on in Ford credit, and then we'll take some Q&As. Real quickly, this shows for 2009, we earned $2 billion in the credit company, and on the right, some of the key metrics that you can see. For example, we ended the year about $95 billion in managed receivables, and with a managed leverage of about 7.3 to 1. We did pay $1.5 billion of dividends to the parent company in 2009 and plan to pay another $1.5 billion of dividends in 2010. We also ended with the allowance at about $1.5 billion or about 161 basis points. Our funding strategy is very straightforward, and it really hasn't changed from last year and what we plan to do. But the key elements continue to be access to capital markets for securitization and unsecured debt funding, extend the term of securitization and unsecured funding when we can, maintain funding programs and renew committed capacity, which is very important for us this year, and then we'll also continue alternative businesses or other funding arrangements, which have been very successful over the last few years. If I go to the next slide, this is where we give a little bit of guidance on where we plan to be for 2010. At the end of the year, we expect the managed receivables to be between $80 and $90 billion. That's coming off the $95 billion at the end of 2009. A lot of it has to do with the fact that we have moved away from Jag, Land Rover, Mazda, along with the lower industry volumes, replacing years of much higher industry volume. We'll continue to drive down the receivables for a few more years before it would eventually start to grow back up. Talk specifically about our funding plan. What's shown here is what we've actually completed in 2007, 8, and 9. And you can see, for example, in 2009, in the term funding market, we completed about $31 billion. Our plans in 2010 is about $12 to $17 billion in public securitizations, $8 to $13 billion in private. And on the right, you can see what we've done to date through, I believe, the February 24th. And you can see we've done $4 billion of public and $1 billion of private. Liquidity is always important to us. At the end of 2009, we ended at about $21 billion. On the top, it shows you our committed capacity. At the end of the year, we had $33.8 billion. And then you can see the makeup of the different pieces. Also about $17 billion of cash, of which $5 billion was related to securitizations. So in total, we had over $51 billion of cash and committed capacity. Back out the cash that's used for securitization, back out the excess capacity, and then add in the utilization of that liquidity of about $18 billion shows you that we had about $21 billion utilization at the end of 2009. I do want to point out one of the key things that we have focused on is renewing committed capacity, primarily through conduits. And during the year, at the beginning of 2009, it was very difficult to renew. I think in the first half of the year, we renewed about 52% of the capacity that was up for renewal. In the second half of the year, we renewed about 83% that was up for renewal. But the good news is in the fourth quarter, it was actually over 90%. So as the time has gone on, we've been much more successful in renewing our capacity. Next slide gives a little bit of a liquidity profile of Ford Credit's of our balance sheet itself. The bars on the left show cumulative principal maturities of on-balance sheet consolidated assets, and the bars on the right show cumulative maturities of debt over the upcoming annual periods. And in 2010, you can see that assets scheduled to mature exceed debt coming due by $23 billion. And in addition, cumulative asset maturities exceed cumulative debt maturities in each of the extended periods shown on the slide, demonstrating that Ford Credit's balance sheet remains very liquid. I want to change direction just a little bit and talk about our origination and servicing strategy. The credit company has been in place to support the automotive company and support sales. But this gives a visual that represents the keys to our success and our collateral performance. On the top, you can see the originate our business, buy it right is what's important. We employ prudent origination practices while purchasing a managed level of risk. The second one is service our portfolio. That's basically collect effectively and efficiency using the latest technology and continuous improvement. And finally, fund our business. And the idea here is obviously to fund the business efficiently while managing our balance sheet risk. If I talk about the origination side of the business, we do have a proprietary scoring model. We call it probability of payment. It is an in-house development of multiple scorecards. It's, you know, large sample sizes. It's based on our experiences and our processes. It is automotive specific because we do have over 50 years of automotive experience in this space. And it is supported by an internal analytics team. And the POP basically not only takes credit bureau data like FICO, but it also takes into consideration the financing product, whether it's a retail lease, the customer characteristics, the stability of income, have we dealt with the customer in the past, as well as contract characteristics itself. And as a result, we think we actually can originate very well, and we think our performance demonstrates that. The other key piece on our performance and minimizing credit losses is a servicing strategy, and I got a couple slides on that. But, you know, credit losses are an expected part of our business, but the objective is to collect within what our expectations were over the life of the contracts. And the collection strategies that we use do, in fact, reduce credit losses. It optimizes utilization resources, and it does increase customer satisfaction. And the next slide, I'll give you a little bit more detail on this. And this is our servicing strategy. We do have behavioral scorecards that we use to identify predictors and calculate what we call the probability of default. And it's looking at the customer contracts and how they're performing. There are many factors that we use, not only stuff that we had from originations, but updated credit bureau information, customer history variables, such as payment patterns. Have we seen a change in the payment patterns? The primary utilization of the probability of default drives us in our collection practices. It drives us on assignment timing, when we start to call a customer. It drives us on our follow-up intensity. It also moves into whether we assign the account to account maintenance, which are more the people that you would call if you changed your address, for example, to make an easy call. We think the customer will pay up, all the way to loss prevention, which is the later stage delinquency. I'm just going to give you a couple slides on some of the results, of our origination and servicing platform. This slide shows credit loss metrics, the loss to receivable ratios by quarter for the last year and a half. And you can see in the fourth quarter, it was down substantially from the fourth quarter of 2008. Same thing on the next slide, which shows Ford Lincoln Mercury U.S. retail and lease portfolio, which is the largest portion of our balance sheet. And you can see while the repossession ratio has been increasing over the last six quarters, one of the key things for us is severity, and the severity has come down dramatically as the auction market has improved dramatically. And you can see we spiked up in the fourth quarter of 08 at 10,700 per severity, dropping back down to 7,700 in the fourth quarter of 2009. I will point out that since the end of the fourth quarter, it has improved a little bit through January and February, a few hundred dollars, and we'll give more on that when we do our earnings release after the first quarter. Over 60-day delinquencies have been very good for us, down to 20 basis points. Since the fourth quarter, January was actually up slightly, but February has come down slightly, so probably around the same 20 basis points at this point in time. But February was actually a very good month for us. If I look at credit loss metrics, this just gives you a historical perspective of Ford Credit and what we've done. Back in the early 2000s, we made a conscious decision to start buying a little higher in the credit spectrum. And you can see we used to do about 670s. We moved up to about the 710, 715 range. And been fairly consistent with that. And you can see there was a little bit of bump up in 2009. The worldwide on-balance sheet loss to receivable ratios, again, back in the early 2000s, very high loss to receivables. 2005, 6, 7, you couldn't ask for a better time period. And then, again, 2008 and 9 as it started to creep up. But our portfolio overall, as we have bought higher in the credit spectrum, is not as bad as it was back in the early 2000s. And the bottom shows the allowance for credit losses and charge-offs. Also on this is Ford Lincoln Mercury, U.S. retail and lease, other credit loss drivers. Repossessions, you can see, early 2000s, very high repossession ratio. Came down during 2005, 6, 7, and then started to move back up in 2008 and 9 as the economy weakened off. Severity has been the one that's always been a real problem in the last couple of years, because that did spike up during 2008 when we took our impairment, for example. But the auction market has come back very strong. You can see for 2009, it's $8,300. I mentioned the fourth quarter was running at about $7,700, and it's actually a little bit better since the end of the fourth quarter at this point in time. Likewise on the over 60-day delinquencies. The lease portfolio is another large portion of our business, and again, this also demonstrates what's going on in the auction market. And you can see on the chart on the right how in the fourth quarter, at constant mix, how low the auction prices were and how it came back all during 2009. By the fourth quarter of 2009 versus the fourth quarter of 2008, 24-month vehicles off lease were coming in about $3,500 a unit better, and the 36-month leases were coming in about $3,300 better. And you can also see, as a result of those changes in auction prices, underneath the chart on the left, it shows the return rates. When auction prices were really in the tank, people were bringing their vehicles back at the end of lease, not surprising, and we were hitting up to 90% And you can see it came back down to the high 60s. We would like to normally have 70-75% of the vehicles come back so we can keep that customer in a new Ford product. But when it hit 90%, it wasn't surprising because they were making the economic decision that their vehicle had lost so much value. We'll point out the bottom right, net operating leases, we have backed off on leasing to a degree. We have about $15 billion of leases on our books at this point in time. Last slide, and I'm going to sum up for Ford and Ford Credit. And as Neil pointed out, we are following our One Ford plan to build great products, a strong business, and a better world. And this is, above all, a product-led transformation. And we are focused on building the Ford brand with complete family of world-class vehicles that lead in quality, safety, fuel economy, smart technology, and best value. In this extraordinary downturn, we have remained committed to our strategy, and it's gratifying to see the progress we are making. And we are confident that we will survive this difficult period and emerge as an exciting, viable Ford Motor Company, delivering profitable growth for all of our stakeholders. Thank you for having us here today, and I'd like to open it up for questions.
I'll get us started, and you guys want us to come to the microphone to do this. KR, looking at the impact of the divested brands and looking out potential rise in SAR and your market share gains, how long can you guys sustain the $1.5 billion dividend to Ford and keep your managed leverage flat?
I'll give you a couple perspectives on that, Eric. We ended the year with, I'd call it, way under leverage at 7.3 on a managed leverage basis. You know, historically, we talk about being 10 to 11 or so. So we got some room to grow at that point to get, we could do more dividends. We've held back on dividends, truthfully, because of the funding environment. When we got into end of 2008, early 2009, we were very worried about the funding environment. We were out of the unsecured market for a good 6-9 months. The funding market comes back over time, longer term, we would take our leverage back up to a more appropriate level. There's no reason to hold excess capital in the credit company. You need to be appropriately capitalized is what I'd call it. I will tell you, with the Jag, Land Rover, Mazda, the receivables all coming down, I mean, we were a $150 billion balance sheet 2 years ago. That frees up a lot of capital. And so far, we've been holding most of it back. We have paid some dividends, but we've held most of it back. You're going to get to a point where we're going to have to appropriately capitalize the credit company, which means dividends back to the parent.
And then, KR, looking at the consumer as we head into the year, I mean, obviously, they benefited last year with the tax refund, and then, you know, the used values going up made everybody a genius on loss severity. How are delinquencies trending going into the year, heading into the tax refund season?
As I mentioned, what we saw, January actually was a little bit of a deterioration, and February was a nice improvement. I don't want to give the impression that it's a huge improvement. They probably average out to be kind of flat versus what we were seeing at the fourth quarter, but the encouraging sign was I'd rather have the second month, February, being better than the first month. It is encouraging. But I think there's a lot of stress going on out there in the marketplace. A lot of consumers are under stress. We still try to work with the consumer, try to keep them in their vehicle. In the end, we don't want to take the vehicle. We're going to end up taking a loss on the vehicle. We'd rather keep them in the vehicle, keep making payments. So we will work with the consumer, give them an extension if that works. You know, all the different techniques that we can use to try to keep them in the vehicle, keep them paying. Worst case, we try to repossess the vehicle.
And then, Neil, just one question for you. You guys have a preferred and dividend you've held out for some quarters, and the common dividend, I think, was canceled a couple years ago. Not a lot of money compared to the liquidity you have at the auto company. Why not reinstate those as a sign of confidence?
I think if you look at our capital strategy today, there's a lot of different instruments. It's not just simply unsecured debt and common stock, which is how it was in the good old days. So when we look at the need to improve our balance sheet, clearly the dividends on the trust preferred will be one of those items that we will consider as part of. But the key to restarting the dividend, the key to paying down our debt is going to be generating operating cash flow and getting the business right. And we're starting to see that at least the last two quarters of 2009 at still a very depressed industry. So as we generate cash, we're going to reinstate other things. We'll pay back debt, and the trust preferred dividend will be part of that.
And then could you prioritize your top three uses of liquidity at the Motorco?
No.
I say pay down debt. This is a debt conference.
Pay down debt is fixing the balance sheet and generating positive cash flow are two that go very well together.
Could you make any comments? Are you seeing any possible increases in traffic in the showroom as a result of Toyota's troubles?
Yeah, I think it's a little early to say, and February is going to be, and we announce sales tomorrow, but February is going to be a weird industry month for a couple of reasons. Toyota is one, but also the weather will make February sales look different or look weird as a result to that. I think from the standpoint of the data that we've seen, there have not been a lot of cross-shopping yet. I think Toyota buyers, from what we could tell, are sitting waiting to see what happens. So I think it's probably too early to tell what the benefit is. I think important to us is we've got a great product line. I mean, we've got cars and trucks that compete very effectively with them. And to the extent that our consumers want to look at Ford, we believe that once we get them to start looking at Ford and sit in Fords, that the conquest rates will be high as well. But it's too early to tell.
Good morning.
I
guess a couple product questions. You showed the slide where you'd replace 70-90% by 2010, 140-160% by 2014. I just want to understand the sort of the specifics behind that. Like, let's use for an example, this year you've refreshed or upgraded the interior on the Fusion and the Edge, but the platform hasn't changed. Is that considered part of that replacement? And then the average age of the fleet, would those go back to a sort of zero age because you've done the interior and the fascia?
No, they need to be major refreshings, so small changes to the interior wouldn't count for that. The new Fusion that was launched last year is in there. You've got the new Mustang this year is clearly there. The Flex last year, the MKS last year, those were new vehicles. On the refreshing ones, the F-Series last year would have been included. Obviously, the Fiesta this year along with the Focus are all included. So it's major refreshings. It's not fascia changes. It's not, changing the radio and in the inside.
Okay. My other question kind of goes on to the last one about the whole Toyota thing. Not so much what the impact is on, share, the goodwill of Ford versus, the tarnishing of Toyota, but the impact that's going to have on companies maybe needing to overreact to even the smallest of warranty issues. Do you think the industry is going to have to sort of overreact for a while on any, even the slightest problem with a new vehicle versus just a service notice for when people bring in their car?
Yeah, I think that the industry, which is somewhat self-policed and somewhat regulatory policed, and I guess we'll see both were at fault in some sense as part of this one. We don't necessarily think there's a need for more regulation. Most of the recalls that we have are ones that we initiate. And so I think that we've taken on the culture that, and I think it's important as you think about Toyota. When Toyota happened, as any other recall happens, we go through our entire system to verify that we don't have a similar supplier, a similar part, to verify that, so it doesn't Toyota, whether it's us, whether it's any of the competitors. And we go through and test our system. We took down a China plant for 2 days because we had a similar part from the same supplier. Until we were able to design it, to go in and look at it, make sure that verify the design, it was fine. And so we started production two days later. So we do that normally as part of the process. So I think our process fits with what the government intends to have and the relationship with NHTSA. The impact on the rest of the industry, you've obviously seen a lot of recent small recalls from a lot of folks around the world. And I don't know if that's a reflection of what's going on in Toyota or if that's just would have happened normally.
You showed the example of like the Ford Focus where you have a U.S. one, European one, you're merging it into a global one, which is great cost savings, but in a way it could also magnify a warranty issue or a mistake. Toyota would be the example. It's getting recalled all over the world. Do you have to had to add an emphasis on situations like that now that you're globalizing so
yeah, there's,
much?
There's a, you've heard a lot and you've read a lot over the last couple of weeks on are you trading, you know, cost reductions to go global versus the risks of having, you know, one product in eight vehicles. And we've had a lot of discussion internally as a result of that. And the biggest argument, if you have common platforms, is you're going to be able to engineer, test, validate one part a lot more intensely than you would if you had eight different parts in eight different vehicles. And the importance for us, and the focus is really the first one. The Fiesta is sort of there, but the focus was designed at the beginning to be a global car. And so all the way from the very start of the product, it was to take into consideration all the markets it sold. The Fiesta was a late ad for North America. And so it's not as common as the Focus will be. And so I think that the engineering, the validation of every single common part is getting much more focus in a global platform than it would have. It's just law of numbers and the ability to actually achieve it. But it is a trade-off. I mean, we're all going global. The more you go global, the more risk that you have a recall that affects broad-based products.
I was hoping you could comment on what you guys are seeing on a year-to-date basis in terms of incentives here in the States, but also overseas, especially not only at Ford, but also competitors, given some of the competitive dynamics going on, major competitors that have taken a bit of a ding.
Yeah, in the U.S., there have actually, you know, incentives have gotten lower. And I think a lot has to do with the fact that if you go back and look, and there's a great correlation between dealer stocks and incentives. When dealer stocks are north of 100 days, you can almost guarantee an incentive is coming. And if you go back to 2007 and early 2008, you had the problem where dealers were maintaining a lot of stock, and as a result of that, you had high incentives. Most of the OEs now are down to somewhere between 50 and 70 days. And that allows, one, the dealers to not have as much stock. It allows them to make sure the stock is the right stock to have, so you don't have an aging, you know, an aging fleet on the dealership, and so you naturally don't have to incentivize as much. So in North America, it clearly has come down. I think you're starting to see in Europe, as the scrappage programs run off, that you're starting to see some higher incentives in some of the European markets. At least January, February is looking more into more incentive spending going on. And I think, to some extent, Europe didn't go through the restructuring that we've gone through here. From the number of manufacturers, they're still producing. A lot of the manufacturers there are government supported, country supported, and so you just didn't have the reduction in vehicle productions because they were all incentivized with cash for clunker type programs that are just starting to work their way out, which is why, you know, last year's industry sales were in the high 15s. You know, our projection this year is somewhere between 13.5 and 14.5, and we're wide because it really is a tough, you know, that's 19 markets that we're in. It's very tough to nail it down. And the impact of the removal of all the subsidies that have been going on. So it's a difficult market right now, and you're starting to see incentives rise. China is so hot, there's very little incentives.
Where are you guys on second-tier wage hires? Where do you think you'll be in 1 year, 2 years? You know, how will that work out?
I think we're not anywhere today. As we start adding production, and we've talked about the 1,200 jobs that are going into Chicago, and the additional jobs going into Michigan, will be using most likely the existing workforce to the extent that they relocate and move. I think the use of Tier 2 labor will be very much dependent upon the industry. If we have a slow growth industry, we'll use less. If the industry picks up and starts to grow significantly, we'll have to add shifts, and that's when the second-tier wage rates play a much bigger role.
Guess I shouldn't have sat down. Let's say, you know, we have, you know, in 2011, 13 million SAR.
Love that.
Where would that, you know, where would that put you?
We have not publicly came out and, you know, what if the industry is and what does that mean for Tier 2? But obviously, we're at 11.5 to 12 to 12.5 is our projection. which we can do with our existing facilities and our existing resources. We're not at full capacity, so getting to 13 would probably not have much of an impact on that wage.
Let's take one more in on the union. You know, the union voted down some of the amendments that GM and Chrysler have gotten. I guess two questions. One, is that a big disadvantage? I mean, the way I look at it, it's, you know, COLA escalators, it's a couple hundred million a year. But is that a big disadvantage competitively versus those two? And then secondly, does that portend any, you know, conflict in 2011 when we go back in contract?
Yeah, I think there were four items. And if you really go back to 07 and then the negotiations we did in February, we basically achieved 95% of what GM got through bankruptcy in the unions before. Because you remember the sequence of events. We went into February with negotiations in a new operating agreement and the new VIVA agreement, and then you had subsequently GM and Chrysler get their new agreements through bankruptcy. When we looked at the agreements, there were basically four things that they got that we didn't have in the original agreement. The biggest one was the no-strike clause on wage and benefits for 2011. So when we went back with the union, the other three issues are issues that we can actually get without a vote. So we'll continue to work with the leadership issue. The non-strike for 11 on wage and benefits is the one item we didn't get that will impact or could impact 11 negotiations. Too early to tell. It'll be very interesting to see the union leadership because they were clearly supportive of what we were trying to do. The rank and file were this, I think, you know, bailout and renegotiated out. And so I think it just took too long between the bankruptcy. We were starting to perform better. They started to see the numbers, and they were ratified out. So I think we'll continue. This has been an industry that has had pattern bargaining forever. So the thought of breaking away from that for three Detroit-based companies is a little hard to get. But we'll have to wait and see. And I think we'll deal with the reality of it and make the right appropriate decisions. Wage and benefits. Correct. And that's true for the others as well. And the no strike comes with an arbitration on, so the extent, and the arbitrator is going to, it's clearly defined that you need to be competitive. And that's our goal. We need to be competitive. And we will be competitive when it comes to labor wages and benefits and work rules and everything that goes with that, because that's our goal. We need to be competitive.
You put up a slide with market share in the United States and Europe. Question for you, what is your global strategy? You're still very underrepresented in some of the growing markets in Asia and elsewhere.
Yeah, we are. The chart I showed was U.S. and Europe. I mentioned South America, which was also up in share on a year-over-year basis. Asia-Pacific, which for us is Asia-Pacific and Africa, had a 2% market share in 2009, which was flat. And if you work the numbers, because of how fast the Asian market grew, we actually went down a couple of tenths of percentage points in global share as a result of the speed in which, despite the growth that we had in the other three major markets. We need to expand our presence in Asia, China and India specifically, and you'll hear more about that as we go forward.
You also displayed several slides about new product introductions at Ford. Question, can you comment upon the product cadence at Lincoln Mercury and what are your plans going forward there?
We've had a decent launch. We have had decent cadence in the Lincoln brand over the last several years with the MKS and the MKT that just got launched at the back half of last year. And we have publicly said there's a new small Lincoln Mercury coming out soon. We have not yet disclosed the names and or the vehicles.
Last question. Can you give us an update in terms of the sale of Volvo, where talks stand, and what the expected use of proceeds is either required to be or expected to be? Thank you.
I'm going to stick with our public disclosure on Volvo that we expect to have a deal signed by the first quarter and close in the second quarter. And we have very specific covenants in our bank deal on use of proceeds, that 50% required of use of proceeds is a mandatory prepayment of the term loan.
Looking at used vehicle prices, they've been pretty much flat sequentially since October. Can you talk about your view on residuals and how you're thinking about that as new vehicle production increases? You'll have a sort of supply pressure.
You know, since the end of the year, we've actually seen auction prices improve a little bit. But, you know, if you look at what's driving a lot of the auction market, in the next couple of years, there'll be a lot less off-lease vehicles coming. A lot of the rental car companies aren't turning the vehicles every 10 months like they used to. And plus, you're going to have, you know, slow industries for the last couple of years. So we kind of look at it in the next few years that the residual values shouldn't probably move too much. From where they are today, but I'll be honest with you. I mean, you know, we didn't think it was going to go down by 20-something percent at the beginning of 2008 like it did. We certainly didn't think it was going to go back up 20-something percent in 2009. So if you thought I was really a great guesser on the auction market, I'm not. But I wouldn't be surprised if it didn't really move that much from where it is today. I think there are a lot of dynamics, both supply and demand, going on for the next couple of years.
Question on the dealership footprint. Your competitors kind of had the luxury of wiping out a lot of dealerships during their bankruptcy process, and arguably maybe they overreacted. I personally live at the very outer edge of an MSA. I've seen a Dodge, Chrysler, Jeep dealership close, Pontiac Buick dealership close, Chevy dealership close. The one that's still there is the Ford dealership. So does it take some pressure off of you guys? Does it give you even a more competitive advantage? And I always think more on the truck side where, you know, small fleet customers, et cetera. How has this all changed your view on the dealership footprint?
Yeah, we've taken very quietly pretty significant action in dealer consolidation. We believe our dealerships and our dealers in general is a competitive advantage for us. We're in a lot of small rural towns around the country, and they are part of their community and are a big part of our overall sales strategy. But that doesn't mean we haven't been reducing dealers. We're down to under 3,600 dealers. That's about an 800 dealer reduction since 2005. But you don't read about it. You don't see them, you know, protesting in front of the Congress, because we're doing it in a way that's in the best interest of us and them. There's been a big focus in the mega dealers, so the mega big city dealers, because consumer over the last decade or two, consumers' willingness to drive distances to buy vehicles, you don't need a dealership in every single city, because people will drive 20 miles, they'll do their research on the web, they'll drive 50 miles if it means they get the car and the color and the price that they want. So our focus in consolidating dealerships is clearly in the big cities, and we have more work to do there. But, you know, GM is, you know, you can see what's going on with their dealerships. They've come out recently and said their new target is 4,200 dealers. We're below 3,600 already. And we'll continue to work it it sounds corny, but in a one Ford way. We're one Ford with our dealers, we're one Ford with our suppliers, and we're going to continue to work to right-size the business. Well, thank you all for coming this morning. Thank you.